hand exposed for coppers, the other clutching her side, would still be there in 10 million years, remembering how once she had walked in May, where the sea flows now, with whom it didn't matter. He was a man, oh yes, a man who had loved her. But the passage of ages had blurred the clarity of that ancient May day. The bright petalled flowers were hoar and silver frosted, and she no longer saw when she implored him, as she did now quite clearly, "Look in my eyes with thy sweet eyes intently." She no longer saw brown eyes, black whiskers, or sunburnt face, but only a looming shape, a shadow shape, to which, with the bird-like freshness of the very aged, she still twittered, "Give me your hand and let me press it gently." Peter Walsh couldn't help giving the poor creature a coin as he stepped into his taxi. "And if someone should see, what matter they?" she demanded. And her fist clutched at her side, and she smiled, pocketing her shilling, and all peering, inquisitive eyes seemed blotted out, and the passing generations, the pavement was crowded with bustling middle-class people, vanished like leaves, to be trodden under, to be soaked and steeped and made mould of by that eternal spring. Ium faum so, fu sui tui mu. A being so differently constituted from herself, with such a command of language, able to put things as editors like them put, had passions which one could not call simply greed. Lady Bruton often suspended judgment upon men in deference to the mysterious accord in which they, but no woman, stood to the laws of the universe, knew how to put things, knew what was said. So that if Richard advised her and Hugh wrote for her, she was sure of being somehow right. So she let Hugh eat his soufflé, asked after poor Evelyn, waited until they were smoking, and then said, "Millie, would you fetch the papers?" And Miss Brush went out, came back, laid papers on the table, and Hugh produced his fountain pen, his silver fountain pen, which had done 20 years' service, he said, unscrewing the cap. It was still in perfect order. He had shown it to the makers. There was no reason, they said, why it should ever wear out, which was, somehow, to Hugh's credit, and to the credit of the sentiments which his pen expressed, so Richard Dalloway felt, as Hugh began carefully writing capital letters with rings round them in the margin, and thus marvellously reduced Lady Bruton's tangles to sense, to grammar such as the editor of the Times, Lady Bruton felt, watching the marvellous transformation, must respect. Hugh was slow. Hugh was pertinacious. Richard said one must take risks. Hugh proposed modifications in deference to people's feelings, which, he said rather tartly when Richard laughed, had to be considered, and read out, "How, therefore, we are of opinion that the times are ripe, the superfluous youth of our ever-increasing population, what we owe to the dead," which Richard thought all stuffing and bunkum, but no harm in it, of course, and Hugh went on drafting sentiments in alphabetical order of the highest nobility, brushing the cigar ash from his waistcoat, and summing up now and then the progress they had made, until, finally, he read out the draft of a letter which Lady Bruton felt certain was a masterpiece. Could her own meaning sound like that? Hugh couldn't guarantee that the editor would put it in, but he would be meeting somebody at luncheon. Whereupon Lady Bruton, who seldom did a graceful thing, stuffed all Hugh's carnations into the front of her dress, and flinging her hands out, called him "My Prime Minister." What she would have done without them both, she didn't know. They rose, and Richard Dalloway strolled off as usual to have a look at the General's portrait, because he meant, whenever he had a moment of leisure, to write a history of Lady Bruton's family. And Millicent Bruton was very proud of her family. But they could wait, she said, looking at the picture, meaning that her family, of military men, administrators, admirals, had been men of action who had done their duty. And Richard's first duty was to his country. But it was a fine face, she said. And all the papers were ready for Richard down at Aldmixton whenever the time came. The Labour government, she meant. Ah, the news from India, she cried. And then, as they stood in the hall, taking yellow gloves from the bowl on the malachite table, and Hugh was offering Miss Brush, with quite unnecessary courtesy, some discarded ticket or other compliment, which she loathed from the depths of her heart and blushed brick red, Richard turned to Lady Bruton, with his hat in his hand, and said, "We shall see you at our party tonight." Whereupon Lady Bruton resumed the magnificence which letter-writing had shattered. She might come, or she might not come. Clarissa had wonderful energy. Parties terrified Lady Bruton, but then she was getting old. So she intimated, standing at her doorway. Handsome, very erect, while her chow stretched behind her, and Miss Brush disappeared into the background with her hands full of papers. But cricket was no mere game. Cricket was important. He could never help reading about cricket. He read the scores in the stock press first, then how it was a hot day, then about a murder case. Having done things millions of times enriched them, though it might be said to take the surface off. The past enriched, and experience, and having cared for one or two people, and so having acquired the power which the young lack, of cutting short, doing what one likes, not caring a rap what people say, and coming and going without any very great expectations. He left his paper on the table and moved off. Which, however, and he looked for his hat and coat, was not altogether true of him. Not tonight, for here he was starting to go to a party at his age, with the belief upon him that he was about to have an experience. But what? Beauty, anyhow. Not the crude beauty of the eye. It was not beauty pure and simple, Bedford Place leading into Russell Square. It was straightness and emptiness, of course, the symmetry of a corridor. But it was also windows lit up, a piano, a gramophone sounding, a sense of pleasure-making hidden, but now and again emerging when, through the uncurtained window, the window left open, one saw parties sitting over tables, young people slowly circling, conversations between men and women, maids idly looking out, a strange comment theirs when work was done, stockings drying on top ledges, a parrot, a few plants. Absorbing, mysterious, of infinite richness, this life. And in the large square, where the cabs shot and swerved so quick, there were loitering couples, dallying, embracing, shrunk up under the shower of a tree. That was moving. So silent, so absorbed, that one passed discreetly, timidly, as if in the presence of some sacred ceremony to interrupt which would have been impious. That was interesting, and so on, into the flare and glare. His light overcoat blew open. He stepped with indescribable idiosyncrasy, leant a little forward, tripped, with his hands behind his back and his eyes still a little hawk-like. He tripped through London, towards Westminster, observing. It was Mrs. Hilbury looking for the door. How late it was getting, and she murmured as the night grew later, and as people went, one found old friends, quiet nooks and corners, and the loveliest views. Did they know, she asked, that they were surrounded by an enchanted garden? Lights and trees and wonderful gleaming lakes and the sky. Just a few fairy lamps, Clarissa Dalloway had said, in the back garden. But she was a magician. It was a park. And she didn't know their names, but friends she knew they were. Friends without names, songs without words, always the best. But there were so many doors, such unexpected places, she could not find her way. "Old Mrs. Hilbury," said Peter. But who was that? That lady standing by the curtain all the evening without speaking. He knew her face, connected her with Boughton. Surely she used to cut up underclothes at the large table in the window. And Davidson, was that her name? "Oh, that's Ellie Henderson," said Sally. Clarissa was really very hard on her. She was a cousin, very poor. Clarissa was hard on people. "She was, rather," said Peter. "Yet," said Sally, in her emotional way, with a rush of that enthusiasm which Peter used to love her for, yet dreaded a little now, so effusive she might become, "how generous to her friends Clarissa was! And what a rare quality one found it! And how sometimes at night, or on Christmas Day, when she counted up her blessings, she put that friendship first. They were young, that was it. Clarissa was pure-hearted, that was it. Peter would think her sentimental. So she was. For she had come to feel that it was the only thing worth saying, what one felt. Cleverness was silly. One must say simply what one felt." "But I do not know," said Peter Walsh, "what I feel." Poor Peter, thought Sally. Why did not Clarissa come and talk to them? That was what he was longing for. She knew it. All the time he was thinking only of Clarissa and was fidgeting with his knife. "He'd not found life simple," Peter said. "His relations with Clarissa had not been simple. It had spoilt his life," he said. They had been so intimate, he and Sally Seaton, it was absurd not to say it. "One could not be in love twice," he said. And what could she say? "Still, it is better to have loved." But he would think her sentimental. He used to be so sharp. "He must come and stay with them in Manchester." "That's all very true," he said. "All very true. He would love to come and stay with them, directly he had done what he had to do in London." "Ah, but that aeroplane! Hadn't Mrs. Dempster always longed to see foreign parts? She had a nephew, a missionary. It soared and shot. She always went on the sea at Margate. Not out of sight of land, but she had no patience with women who were afraid of water. It swept and fell. Her stomach was in her mouth. Up again. 'There's a fine young feller aboard of it,' Mrs. Dempster wagered. And away it went, fast and fading. Away and away the aeroplane shot, soaring over Greenwich and all the masts. Over the little island of grey churches, St. Paul's and the rest, till, on either side of London, fields spread out and dark brown woods, where adventurous thrushes, hopping boldly, glancing quickly, snatched the snail and tapped him on a stone, once, twice, thrice. Away and away the aeroplane shot, till it was nothing but a bright spark, an aspiration, a concentration, a symbol, so it seemed to Mr. Bentley, vigorously rolling his strip of turf at Greenwich, of man's soul, of his determination, thought Mr. Bentley, sweeping round the cedar tree, to get outside his body, beyond his house, by means of thought, Einstein, speculation, mathematics, the Mendelian theory. Away the aeroplane shot. Then, while a seedy-looking, nondescript man carrying a leather bag stood on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral and hesitated, for within was what balm, how great a welcome, how many tombs with banners waving over them, tokens of victories not over armies, but over, he thought, that plaguey spirit of truth-seeking which leaves me at present without a situation. And more than that, the cathedral offers company, he thought, invites you to membership of a society. Great men belong to it. Martyrs have died for it. Why not enter in, he thought. Put this leather bag stuffed with pamphlets before an altar, a cross, the symbol of something which has soared beyond seeking and questing and knocking of words together, and has become all spirit, disembodied, ghostly. Why not enter in, he thought. And while he hesitated, out flew the aeroplane over Ludgate Circus. It was strange. It was still. Not a sound was to be heard above the traffic. Unguided, it seemed, sped of its own free will. And now, curving up and up, straight up, like something mounting in ecstasy, in pure delight, out from behind poured white smoke looping, writing a T, an O, an F.
This ends Disc 1.
It was a splendid morning, too. Like the pulse of a perfect heart, life struck straight through the streets. There was no fumbling, no hesitation. Sweeping and swerving, accurately, punctually, noiselessly, there, precisely at the right instant, the motor car stopped at the door. The girl, silk-stockinged, feathered, evanescent, but not to him particularly attractive, for he had had his fling, alighted. Admirable butlers, tawny chow-dogs, halls laid in black and white lozenges with white blinds blowing, Peter saw through the opened door and approved of. A splendid achievement in its own way, after all. London, the season, civilization. Coming as he did from a respectable Anglo-Indian family, which for at least three generations had administered the affairs of a continent, it's strange, he thought, what a sentiment I have about that, disliking India and empire and army as he did. There were moments when civilization, even of this sort, seemed dear to him as a personal possession. Moments of pride in England, in butlers, chow dogs, girls in their security. Ridiculous enough, still, there it is, he thought. And the doctors and men of business and capable women all going about their business, punctual, alert, robust, seemed to him wholly admirable, good fellows to whom one would entrust one's life, companions in the art of living, who would see one through. What with one thing and another, the show was really very tolerable, and he would sit down in the shade and smoke. There was Regent's Park. Yes. As a child, he had walked in Regent's Park. Odd, he thought, how the thought of childhood keeps coming back to me. The result of seeing Clarissa, perhaps. For women live much more in the past than we do, he thought. They attach themselves to places, and their fathers. A woman's always proud of her father. Boughton was a nice place, a very nice place. But I could never get on with the old man, he thought. There was quite a scene one night, an argument about something or other, what he couldn't remember. Politics, presumably. Yes, he remembered Regent's Park. The long, straight walk. The little house where one bought airballs to the left. An absurd statue with an inscription somewhere or other. He looked for an empty seat. He didn't want to be bothered, feeling a little drowsy as he did, by people asking him the time. An elderly grey nurse with a baby asleep in its perambulator, that was the best he could do for himself. Sit down at the far end of the seat by that nurse. She's a queer-looking girl, he thought, suddenly remembering Elizabeth as she came into the room and stood by her mother. Grown big, quite grown up, not exactly pretty, handsome, rather, and she can't be more than 18. Probably she doesn't get on with Clarissa. There's my Elizabeth, that sort of thing. Why not here's Elizabeth, simply, trying to make out, like most mothers, that things are what they're not. She trusts to her charm too much, he thought. She overdoes it. The rich, benignant cigar smoke eddied coolly down his throat. He puffed it out again in rings which breasted the air bravely for a moment. Blue, circular. I shall try and get a word alone with Elizabeth tonight, he thought. then began to wobble into hourglass shapes and taper away. Odd shapes they take, he thought. Suddenly he closed his eyes, raised his hand with an effort, and threw away the heavy end of his cigar. A great brush swept smooth across his mind, sweeping across it moving branches, children's voices, the shuffle of feet, and people passing and humming traffic, rising and falling traffic. Down, down he sank into the plumes and feathers of sleep, sank and was muffled over.
This ends Disc 2.
Poor old woman, said Raizia Warren Smith, waiting to cross. Oh, poor old wretch. Suppose it was a wet night. Suppose one's father, or somebody who had known one in better days, had happened to pass, and saw one standing there in the gutter. And where did she sleep at night? Cheerfully, almost gaily, the invincible thread of sound wound up into the air like the smoke from a cottage chimney, winding up clean beech trees and issuing in a tuft of blue smoke among the topmost leaves. And if someone should see, what matter they? Since she was so unhappy, for weeks and weeks now, Raizia had given meanings to things that happened. Almost felt sometimes that she must stop people in the street, if they looked good, kind people, just to say to them, I am unhappy. And this old woman singing in the street, if someone should see, what matter they, made her suddenly quite sure that everything was going to be right. They were going to Sir William Bradshaw. She thought his name sounded nice. He would cure Septimus at once. And then there was a brewer's cart, and the grey horses had upright bristles of straw in their tails. There were newspaper placards. It was a silly, silly dream, being unhappy. So they crossed Mr. and Mrs. Septimus Warren Smith. And was there, after all, anything to draw attention to them? Anything to make a passer-by suspect, here is a young man who carries in him the greatest message in the world, and is, moreover, the happiest man in the world, and the most miserable? Perhaps they walked more slowly than other people, and there was something hesitating, trailing, in the man's walk. But what more natural for a clerk, who has not been in the West End on a weekday at this hour for years, than to keep looking at the sky, looking at this, that, and the other? As if Portland Place were a room he had come into when the family are away, the chandeliers being hung in holland bags, and the caretaker, as she lets in long shafts of dusty light upon deserted, queer-looking armchairs, lifting one corner of the long blinds, explains to the visitors what a wonderful place it is. How wonderful, but at the same time, he thinks, as he looks at chairs and tables, how strange. And Lady Bruton went ponderously, majestically up to her room, lay, one arm extended, on the sofa. She sighed, she snored, not that she was asleep, only drowsy and heavy, like a field of clover in the sunshine this hot June day, with the bees going round and about and the yellow butterflies. Always she went back to those fields down in Devonshire, where she had jumped the brooks on Patty, her pony, with Mortimer and Tom, her brothers. And there were the dogs, there were the rats, there were her father and mother on the lawn under the trees, with the tea things out, and the beds of dahlias, the hollyhocks, the pampas grass. And they, little wretches, always up to some mischief, stealing back through the shrubbery so as not to be seen, all bedraggled from some roguery. What old nurse used to say about her frocks. Ah, dear, she remembered, it was Wednesday in Brook Street. Those kind good fellows, Richard Dalloway, Hugh Whitbread, had gone this hot day through the streets whose growl came up to her lying on the sofa. Power was hers, position, income. She had lived in the forefront of her time, She had had good friends, known the ablest men of her day. Murmuring London flowed up to her, and her hand, lying on the sofa back, curled upon some imaginary baton such as her grandfather's might have held, holding which she seemed, drowsy and heavy, to be commanding battalions marching to Canada, and those good fellows walking across London, that territory of theirs, that little bit of carpet, Mayfair. And they went further and further from her, being attached to her by a thin thread, since they had lunched with her, which would stretch and stretch, get thinner and thinner as they walked across London. As if one's friends were attached to one's body after lunching with them by a thin thread, which, as she dozed there, became hazy with the sound of bells striking the hour or ringing to service, as a single spider's thread is blotted with raindrops and, burdened, sags down. So she slept.
This ends Disc 4.
Was everybody dining out, then? Doors were being opened here by a footman to let issue a high-stepping old dame in buckled shoes with three purple ostrich feathers in her hair. Doors were being opened for ladies wrapped like mummies in shawls with bright flowers on them, ladies with bare heads, and in respectable quarters with stucco pillars, through small front gardens, lightly swathed with combs in their hair, having run up to see the children, women came. Men waited for them, with their coats blowing open, and the motor started. Everybody was going out. What with these doors being opened, and the descent and the start, it seemed as if the whole of London were embarking in little boats moored to the bank, tossing on the waters, as if the whole place were floating off in carnival. And Whitehall was skated over, silver-beaten as it was, skated over by spiders. And there was a sense of midges round the arc lamps. It was so hot that people stood about talking. And here in Westminster was a retired judge, presumably, sitting four square at his house door, dressed all in white. An Anglo-Indian, presumably. And here a shindy of brawling women, drunken women. Here only a policeman and looming houses, high houses, domed houses, churches, parliaments, and the hoot of a steamer on the river, a hollow, misty cry. But it was her street, this, Clarissa's. Cabs were rushing round the corner, like water round the piers of a bridge, drawn together, it seemed to him, because they bore people going to her party, Clarissa's party. The cold stream of visual impressions failed him now, as if the eye were a cup that overflowed and let the rest run down its china walls unrecorded. The brain must wake now, the body must contract now, entering the house, the lighted house, where the door stood open, where the motor cars were standing, and bright women descending. The soul must brave itself to endure. He opened the big blade of his pocket knife.
This ends Disc 6.
And Clarissa had cared for him more than she had ever cared for Richard. Sally was positive of that. "No, no, no," said Peter. Sally should not have said that. She went too far. That good fellow. There he was at the end of the room, holding forth. The same as ever. Dear old Richard. "Who is he talking to?" Sally asked. "That very distinguished-looking man." Living in the wilds, as she did, she had an insatiable curiosity to know who people were. But Peter didn't know. He didn't like his looks, he said, probably a cabinet minister. Of them all, Richard seemed to him the best, he said, the most disinterested. "But what has he done?" Sally asked. "Public work," she supposed. "And were they happy together?" Sally asked. She herself was extremely happy. For, she admitted, she knew nothing about them, only jumped to conclusions, as one does. "For what can one know, even of the people one lives with every day?" she asked. "Are we not all prisoners?" She had read a wonderful play about a man who scratched on the wall of his cell, and she had felt that was true of life. one scratched on the wall. Despairing of human relationships, people were so difficult, she often went into her garden and got from her flowers a piece which men and women never gave her. But no, he did not like cabbages. He preferred human beings, Peter said. Indeed, the young are beautiful, Sally said, watching Elizabeth cross the room. How unlike Clarissa at her age. Could he make anything of her? She would not open her lips. Not much, not yet, Peter admitted. She was like a lily, Sally said, a lily by the side of a pool. But Peter did not agree that we know nothing. We know everything, he said. At least he did. But these two, Sally whispered, these two coming now. And really, she must go if Clarissa didn't come soon. This distinguished-looking man and his rather common-looking wife who had been talking to Richard. What could one know about people like that? That they're damnable humbugs, said Peter, looking at them casually. He made Sally laugh. But Sir William Bradshaw stopped at the door to look at a picture. He looked in the corner for the engraver's name. His wife looked too. Sir William Bradshaw was so interested in art. To look at, he might have been a clerk, but of the better sort, for he wore brown boots. His hands were educated. So too his profile, his angular, big-nosed, intelligent, sensitive profile. But not his lips altogether, for they were loose. And his eyes, as eyes tend to be, eyes merely, hazel, large. So that he was, on the whole, a border case, neither one thing nor the other. Might end with a house at Purley and a motor car, or continue renting apartments in back streets all his life. One of those half-educated, self-educated men whose education is all learnt from books borrowed from public libraries, read in the evening after the day's work, on the advice of well-known authors consulted by letter. As for the other experiences, the solitary ones, which people go through alone, in their bedrooms, in their offices, walking the fields and the streets of London, he had them. Had left home, a mere boy, because of his mother. She lied. Because he came down to tea for the 50th time with his hands unwashed. Because he could see no future for a poet in Stroud. And so, making a confidant of his little sister, had gone to London, leaving an absurd note behind him, such as great men have written and the world has read later when the story of their struggles has become famous. London has swallowed up many millions of young men called Smith. Thought nothing of fantastic Christian names like Septimus, with which their parents have thought to distinguish them. Lodging off the Euston Road, there were experiences, again experiences, such as change a face in 2 years from a pink, innocent oval to a face lean, contracted, hostile. But of all this, what could the most observant of friends have said, except what a gardener says when he opens the conservatory door in the morning and finds a new blossom on his plant? It has flowered. Flowered from vanity, ambition, idealism, passion, loneliness, courage, laziness, the usual seeds, which all muddled up in a room off the Euston Road, made him shy and stammering, made him anxious to improve himself, made him fall in love with Miss Isabel Pole, lecturing in the Waterloo Road upon Shakespeare. Was he not like Keats, she asked, and reflected how she might give him a taste of Antony and Cleopatra and the rest, lent him books, wrote him scraps of letters, and lit in him such a fire as burns only once in a lifetime, without heat, flickering a red-gold flame infinitely ethereal and insubstantial over Miss Pole, Antony and Cleopatra, and the Waterloo Road. He thought her beautiful, believed her impeccably wise, dreamed of her, wrote poems to her, which, ignoring the subject, she corrected in red ink. He saw her one summer evening, walking in a green dress in a square. "It has flowered," the gardener might have said, had he opened the door. Had he come in, that is to say, any night about this time, and found him writing, found him tearing up his writing, found him finishing a masterpiece at 3 o'clock in the morning and running out to pace the streets, and visiting churches, and fasting one day, drinking another, devouring Shakespeare, Darwin, the history of civilization, and Bernard Shaw.
This ends Disc 3.
"When one was young," said Peter, "one was too much excited to know people. Now that one was old, 52 to be precise. Sally was 55 in body," she said, "but her heart was like a girl's of 20. "Now that one was mature, then," said Peter, "one could watch, one could understand, and one did not lose the power of feeling," he said. "No, that's true," said Sally. "She felt more deeply, more passionately, every year." "It increased," he said, "alas, perhaps. But one should be glad of it. It went on increasing in his experience. There was someone in India. He would like to tell Sally about her. He would like Sally to know her. She was married," he said. "She had two small children." "They must all come to Manchester," said Sally. "He must promise before they left." "There's Elizabeth," he said. "She feels not half what we feel. Not yet." "But," said Sally, watching Elizabeth go to her father, "one can see they are devoted to each other." She could feel it by the way Elizabeth went to her father. For her father had been looking at her as he stood talking to the Bradshaws, and he had thought to himself, "Who is that lovely girl?" And suddenly he realized that it was his Elizabeth, and he had not recognized her, she looked so lovely in her pink frock. Elizabeth had felt him looking at her as she talked to Willie Titcomb. So she went to him, and they stood together, now that the party was almost over, looking at the people going, and the rooms getting emptier and emptier, with things scattered on the floor. Even Ellie Henderson was going, nearly last of all, though no one had spoken to her. But she had wanted to see everything, to tell Edith. And Richard and Elizabeth were rather glad it was over. But Richard was proud of his daughter. And he had not meant to tell her, but he could not help telling her. He had looked at her, he said, and he had wondered, "Who is that lovely girl?" And it was his daughter. That did make her happy. But her poor dog was howling. "Richard has improved. You're right," said Sally. "I shall go and talk to him. I shall say good night." "What does the brain matter," said Lady Rossiter, getting up, "compared with the heart?" "I will come," said Peter. But he sat on for a moment. "What is this terror? What is this ecstasy?" he thought to himself. "What is it that fills me with extraordinary excitement?" "It is Clarissa," he said, "for there she was."
The End. You've been listening to Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, narrated by Virginia Leishman. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, you'll find a wide selection of titles in the Clipper catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So, to order another Clipper audiobook, or for a copy of our latest listings, please call us using the telephone number on the back of this book. Clipper Audio is also represented on the World Wide Web at www.recordedbooks.com, where you can browse the catalogue and hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. And thank you for listening to Clipper Audio Books.